Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's move on now with our week in review. There's a lot to talk about, including yesterday's guilty verdict in the federal corruption trial of former probation chief John O'Brien and two of his assistants.
In another high-profile court case this week, a jury found Azamat Tazayakov guilty of obstructing the investigation into the Boston Marathon bombings. And there's growing resistance to Governor Patrick's plan to temporarily house immigrant children from Central America here in Massachusetts.
And, of course, the continuing story around Market Basket, the supermarket company. As we heard before the break, thousands of employees rallied today at company headquarters in Tewksbury, demanding that ousted CEO Arthur T. Demoulas be reinstated, while the board of directors met in Boston to consider the company's next move. So let's begin there. Joining us now is John Carroll. He's a mass communications professor at Boston University. Hey, John, good to see you.
Good to be here.
And Dante Ramos. He's the deputy editorial page editor for the Boston Globe and joins us from Morrissey Boulevard. Dante, good to have you.
Great to be here.
So let's start with Market Basket, a family feud. Thousands are protesting today. Meanwhile, Market Basket shelves are empty or getting there, and a bid from the ousted CEO, Arthur T. Demoulas, to regain a majority share in the family business. Dante, what should Market Basket do to end this foment and move forward as a profitable business?
It's a situation that it's hard to see how it ends well exactly, because it seems unlikely, partly given the report that you just had, that the board of the company, which is now controlled by the Arthur S. Demoulas faction, is going to say, okay, never mind, Arthur T., you come back. It raises the possibility that the chain might be bought out by somebody else. It raises the possibility that Arthur T. might succeed in his buyout bid, but it's been said that if that happens, he'll probably have to borrow a lot of money to make that happen, and that would squeeze some of the some of the margins that have made it possible for Market Basket to operate the way that it has. The thing to remember is that Market Basket has been operating in a way that many worker advocates would think is almost the ideal, in the sense that the prices are lower than the market would sustain, the wages are higher, people stay for a long time, and people feel like they have a voice in how the company is run. But, you know, this is also possible because it's a family business, because Arthur T. made a decision to run the business that way. And over time, you know, you get into the third or the fourth generation of a family business, and people are less committed to that model, and there's more people who want to have a say in how the business is run. So it's hard to maintain a consistent strategy. It's hard to imagine that ultimately that the genie will be put back in the bottle, so to speak.
Yeah, really hard to imagine. John Carroll, I guess one of the obvious lessons here is that family feuds are not good for business.
No, if this were a Little League game, they would invoke the mercy rule at this point. Because this is the biggest mismatch you could possibly imagine. I mean, the board has to be sitting there thinking, we picked the wrong way to go on this one. And at Harvard Business School, it's actually called the Yertle the Turtle Gambit. I mean, there is no counter-narrative to what the workers are communicating to the public. The public has nothing to latch onto. I'm not saying that the board of directors has a great story to tell, but they've told no story up to this point. They've had some bloodless press statements. They had a bloodless ad that they ran in the Boston Globe. They're hoping that this will just go away. And
doesn't look like that's going to happen.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
It may be a situation where it's like Vietnam. You know, they destroy the village in order to save it. And I just don't see what their end game is at this point.
Well, yesterday we spoke to Tom Cohan. He's a labor economist at the MIT Sloan School of Management. He called this protest unprecedented in U.S. labor history, noting that it's made up of a broad coalition from rank-and-file workers to clerks to middle managers, and said it sends a strong message to corporate America. So here's what he said.
What these employees are saying is, we matter as well, and we can really make this company successful. We've built it, we've made it work effectively, and we want to continue to do so and commit our energies with a boss that we trust and a boss who respects us.
So larger lesson there, perhaps. Dante, is this just a story about one family-owned business, or is there some broader significance here?
No, of course there's a broader significance. We've been talking a lot politically and on the show and elsewhere about these broader concerns about inequality in the world and about people feeling like there's a squeeze on middle class jobs and people feeling in general that retail jobs are the only ones available and they're paying low wages and don't have full-time hours and don't have benefits. And here's a clear counter example of that. Market Basket is really running counter to trends. And so I think, you know, you hear the customer showing up at these protests. It's not probably just because because they like the cheap prices on eggs, but there's also a feeling that there's a larger cause at stake here.
John and Dante, I also want to get your thoughts on the big local courthouse news yesterday, which was the guilty verdicts in the federal corruption trial of the former probation commissioner John O'Brien and two of his former deputies, Elizabeth Tavares and William Burke. Basically, jurors agreed with the prosecutor's argument that this trio orchestrated a sham hiring scheme that essentially traded jobs in the probation department for legislative favors. Here is William Burke's attorney, John Amabile. He said the verdict was a shock to the defendants.
I respect the jury, but I think the verdict today was a miscarriage of justice. I think that the verdict amounts to scapegoating low-level functionaries without really any kind of a notice for long-standing political practices.
Now, not surprisingly, U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, whose office prosecuted the case, disagrees with that.
I really take issue with three defendants that were in court as being just mere functionaries or bureaucrats. The head of the probation department and his right-hand people in charge of an agency that employed over 1,800 individuals.
Now, Dante, your paper editorialized today that this verdict sends a strong message about the need to crack down on Beacon Hill's corporate culture. And the Globe Spotlight team reporting, of course, brought this patronage culture to light. How do you reconcile these two views between sort of focusing on low-level functionaries versus Ortiz's argument that they got the right people?
In the case of the probation officials talking about low-level functionaries, certainly in O'Brien's case, the probation boss, to describe him as a low-level functionary, I think, is to underestimate the influence that he wielded on Beacon Hill. It's also the case that, you know, the attorney for Burke was suggesting that they're being scapegoated for what happens all the time. I think what's unusual about this case, the suggestion is that they were prosecuted not out of general corruption, but because they went much further than most acts of political patronage do.
And we should repeat here that, of course, repeatedly the judge says patronage is not illegal. It's the covering up of it, the sort of corruption aspect that is.
Exactly. And what they were said to have done, I mean, they were convicted on mail fraud charges connected with phonying up this formal system that had been set up to avoid precisely the type of political patronage practices that ended up going on. And so there are certain types of jobs in government that are political appointees, or there are certain types of jobs that are not really meant to be merit appointees. Somebody gets elected to office, they get to recommend their own people for them. An ambassador is like this. A U.S. attorney is like this. They're political appointments. The probation jobs specifically were not supposed to be this. There was supposed to be a merit-based hiring system, which the whole crux of the case was that O'Brien and his aides paid lip service to that, pretended that that was really going on, while essentially faking that system and making sure that their desired outcome became true.
John Carroll, part of the defense strategy, the defense argument, was basically everybody does this. It doesn't just happen in probation. It's how government works. That seems maybe not to have resonated with the jury, or maybe it did, but they felt like that doesn't get this trio off the hook. Do you feel like this changes anything? Will it change the way government operates?
I think people will be more careful about what they do, for one thing. I mean, I would use the Agnes Carroll response, which is, if everybody jumps off the Empire State Building, are you going to jump off too? I mean, you know, this is something that is business as usual, but the court decided that, and the jury decided that it's corrupt business as usual.
And actually, there was a legislator quoted in a paper today saying, "I'm not going to write another recommendation letter until this stuff is clarified."
I think it's going to make everybody wary of the whole situation. But from a public standpoint, I think it's an easy sell to the public, this conviction, and the fact that they were shocked tells me they're sort of living in
the
bubble,
sure,
a little bit. Yeah, but there's two other groups that profited from this as well. There's the politicians who profited by placing their people there, and the people who got the jobs. And those are the people who don't seem to have come to justice at all.
All right. Well, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into this story. And to help us do that, we're joined by Harvey Silverglate. He's a Boston criminal defense and civil liberties litigator. And Harvey, good to have you.
Good to be here.
And we asked you on today because you wrote a really provocative, interesting piece in Mass Lawyers Weekly today, arguing that this case may have been prosecutorial overreach. Give us a reason why.
Well, this is a case in which the judge had to give the jury a virtual telephone book of instructions in order to try to figure out a way to shoehorn what is really state political culture into one of the federal corruption statutes, the racketeering statutes. And when you have a shoehorning like this, where there is so much disagreement over whether this does constitute, assuming all of the government's evidence is taken as true, whether this really constitutes a federal criminal racketeering violation or not, when you have that kind of disagreement among the people who really know the law, you know there's something wrong. That's what overreach is all about. The feds trying to criminalize state political culture.
Mm. But isn't that the role of federal prosecutors? I mean, sometimes to step in and help states sort of enforce their own laws. I mean, we did have this system of merit-based hiring. O'Brien clearly figured out a way to go around it. It was illegal.
Well, the role of the feds is to enforce federal law, federal criminal law. It is not to help the states in an area where the Fed should have no constitutional role. And they really have no constitutional role with regard to state political culture. This doesn't mean that they're not going to get away with it, because the feds for the last 25 years have been getting away with prosecutions like this, not only here but all over the country. They indicted and convicted Rod Blagojevich, the governor of Illinois, for, quote, selling the empty Senate seat that was vacated by Barack Obama. Well, of course, it's quite normal political culture for a governor who has this appointment authority to appoint somebody who's helped him politically. He wasn't getting money, he was getting political help. Well, he's sitting in prison too. This is not just a Massachusetts problem, but it is a huge civil liberties problem involving federal prosecutorial overreach.
Mm. Well, Dante, the Globe editorial today says the O'Brien verdict clarifies at least this much: accepting a wad of cash while under video surveillance isn't the only form of public corruption. Do you think or respond to Harvey's suggestion that this may have been prosecutorial overreach? What do you think?
Well, part of Harvey's premise is that what transpired here was basically normal garden variety state political culture, and I don't think that's really true. I mean, you know, this wasn't a case of somebody driving 27 in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. If anything, it was like driving 100 miles an hour while drunk and hitting three parked cars. I mean, what went on in the probation case was an order of magnitude beyond what goes on, I think, in normal state political culture. The other thing about states being incumbent upon states to take care of these sort of things, it has been a trend, and maybe it's a trend that Harvey wouldn't necessarily welcome, that the federal government ends up getting involved in a lot of local and state level public integrity issues, in part because the state laws or the state the state political institutions are not all that responsive to these sorts of claims, or are not thought to be impartial enough to handle it, and the federal judiciary is thought to be more so. And I guess the other thing to say is that there is a sort of philosophical dispute here, and I think we would all probably agree that somebody being caught on video, as we said in the editorial, somebody being caught on video taking a bribe and saying, hey, I'm doing this for that as a quid pro quo, that would be obvious mm-hmm. evidence of political corruption. But I think that most people feel like there are corrosive elements of the system that go beyond that, and that state level actors, in this case O'Brien, go beyond state level protections, such as the merit system in the probation department, in order to achieve political ends public interest.
You raise a really interesting point that I'd love to get Harvey to respond to. This idea, Harvey, that when it comes to issues of public integrity, we need the feds to get involved because sometimes state statutes just aren't up to the job.
Well, it's up to the state to decide what the job is. Dante said we have a philosophical difference. We don't really have a philosophical difference. We have a constitutional difference. This goes way beyond what the federal government should be doing in the state of Massachusetts. I want to point out that we may have our problems with political culture, but in fact, I think you'd have to be blind to deny that the Massachusetts legislature operates better than the U.S. Congress. And we have our problems with the culture, but Congress has even more. And so the Department of Justice should turn to the Congress, not to the legislature of Massachusetts. We have a remedy here, you know, it's called elections. I'm not happy with the fact that we have a one-party state, and we've had it for most of my residence here in Massachusetts since 1964. But we do have a one party. The voters of Massachusetts have chosen to let this happen. I wish they would choose not to let it happen.
All right. Well, that's Boston criminal defense attorney Harvey Silverglade. Harvey, thanks so much for joining us and for at least making us think about this. We're grateful.
Thank you.
And you can find a link to Harvey's opinion piece and other opinion pieces about the O'Brien verdict at RadioBoston.org.
Dante and Jean, another big verdict this week. It was the trial of one of the friends of the alleged Boston Marathon bomber, Jahar Tsarnaev. Azamat Tazayakov was found guilty Monday of obstructing a terror investigation by having discarded a backpack or trying to discard a backpack that belonged to Tsarnaev. In other words, getting rid of evidence. Now, one of the defense attorneys, Matthew Myers, says Tazayakov is innocent, but that he has to respect the verdict.
We understand that when your city has been through a traumatic event, that jurors come in with a certain bias. It's hard to overcome that bias. The jurors under a certain pressure by the community to possibly render a certain verdict.
John Carroll, there have been many sort of change of venue discussions and requests throughout this trial. How do you balance in your mind the argument that it really is tough to get a fair trial in Boston, given the massive impact of that event on this city?
I think it's hard in many cases to get a fair trial, but it happens all the time. So I think that it will be used as an argument. I mean, Tazayakov was, it seems anyway, from the report so far, a minor player in the disposal of the laptop and the backpack. However, he stands to serve 25 years. So I think that this is a leading indicator of how seriously the juries are going to be taking these actions and how punitive the results will probably be. I think they will make an argument for a change of venue. I don't think they'll get it. And I don't necessarily think they can't get a fair trial here, but they're going to get a tough trial.
And Dante, of course, there are two more related trials coming for two other friends of Jahar Tsarnaev. What does the verdict this week tell you in terms of what we might be, what these two defendants might experience in their own trials?
In a way, in the Tazayakov case, what seems to be more telling to me is what kind of sentence he ends up getting, and that hasn't been determined yet. It wasn't ultimately that surprising to me that he was convicted as being part of this enterprise of getting rid of some evidence, but whether he ends up receiving a long sentence or a short sentence, sort of has a lot to do with whether justice is ultimately served or not served. In the case of some of these other trials coming up for Jahar Tsarnaev's associates, it's clear that the federal government has charged these cases pretty aggressively, that they are pursuing them very aggressively. I think the assessment is probably that, you know, this is what they do in cases that they deem to be terrorism. Also, there's a feeling that this is a severely disruptive event for the city and that it warrants that kind of aggressive tactic.
Well, let's move on and talk quickly about the controversy and heated debate this week around Governor Patrick's decision to welcome some of those immigrant children who crossed illegally into the U.S. From Mexico. Patrick says Camp Edwards on Cape Cod could house them temporarily until federal authorities process them. Not everyone down on the Cape has welcomed that idea. Here's select woman Linda Zern of Bourne on Cape Cod.
It's our town. And we don't even know what's going on. We don't know how many people are coming. We don't know if they're gang members or whatever. My feeling is that this whole invasion of our country is against the Constitution.
Now, the Bourne board voted unanimously to send a letter to Governor Patrick saying the children would not be welcome in their community. Our reporter, Asma Khalid, spent a lot of time down there and reports that that attitude was... if not pervasive, it was the loudest attitude expressed in that community. John, why do you think this proposal is sparking these strong feelings?
Well, there's a lot of moving parts here, and only part of it is, I think, has to do with immigration. Part of it has to do, I think, with people's trust in government and whether the government is actually telling them and predicting what will happen. Governor Patrick is saying they'll be here for an average of 35 days. I don't think anybody believes that. He says that the federal government is going to pick up the tab for all of it. I don't think very many people believe that either. And I think so that's part of it, and it just complicates what's already a pretty complicated issue in terms of immigration, the lack of immigration reform, the lack of congressional action on this. I mean, they're going on an August recess. They're just going to leave this sitting there. So there's a lot of this that's sort of in limbo. And it goes beyond sort of racial issues. I think that to just paint everybody who's opposed to this as having racial bias is wrong, because I think that there are a whole lot of aspects of this that give people pause, and in some cases with good reason.
Dante, I'd love to hear you on this. You know, I've wondered sort of from the start if Governor Patrick made one mistake in this. I mean, we know that he expressed this from his heart and feels passionately that this is the right thing to do. But maybe he should have discussed this plan with community leaders before taking it public. What do you think?
It's certainly a situation where there's a divide, not just between, you know, typically on immigration issues, there's said to be a divide between elite opinion and opinion among working class and lower class voters who feel like immigration, for various reasons, is a threat, economic and otherwise. In the case of state and local leaders, Patrick is clearly speaking from a philosophical standpoint. You do hear, however, from municipal leaders who feel like there are, you know, that there are issues to be dealt with at the municipal level. That, you know, as John said, if people really aren't, if the people who were brought up here are really not departing within a short period of time, it does become a question of do they end up going to local schools, are they settled with local families, that kind of thing. So, you know, you do hear municipal officials saying like, well, wait a minute, we're not totally down with this situation yet, and we at the very least need more information. You know, I thought that there's another strand at play here. You know, the select woman from Bourne that you interviewed,
Linda Zern,
was speaking about it in somewhat more apocalyptic terms, in terms of gang members and invasion. You know, those are fairly inflammatory terms, but you know, other municipal officials have brought up more concrete concerns that Patrick probably should have tried to take into account in advance.
Dante and John, before we go, let's turn to our hubbubs, those little stories that may have slipped off the radar of many people that we caught. Dante, which one did you see this week?
Well, I want to give a shout out to The Lion's Roar, which is the student newspaper at Newton South High School.
Yes.
They're the ones who revealed this week that a commencement speech by their superintendent in Newton, David Fleischman, had borrowed a number of lines from Governor Patrick's speeches. Now, none of this was War and Peace, you know, that typical commencement speech platitudes, you might say. But the report in The Lion's Roar was a reminder that student journalism, which sometimes comes under threat from school administrations, has a very important watchdog to play, like all journalism does. I thought that actually the most telling tribute came from David Fleischman himself, who lost a week's salary over this, but he conceded that the Lion's Roar article had been an invaluable reminder, he called it, of the need to be careful.
Dante, I went online and read that today. It is worth reading. It's written in first person by two students. They truly sound shaken, and they sort of feel like they're righting a wrong. I encourage people to go to the website and read it. John Carroll, what do you have for your hubbub this week?
Well, researchers at Harvard and the University and the University of British Columbia have released a study on the unhappiest cities in America. And the splendid listeners of Radio Boston will be pleased to know, drum roll, the unhappiest city in America is New York, New York.
Money doesn't buy everything.
A city so unhappy they named it twice. The big town was number 359. I'm sure this was a self-reported study, so some people have sort of poo-pooed it. Everyone's going to want to know where Boston ranked. Boston ranked number 284. So we're slightly less unhappy than New Yorkers.
I'm happy with 284.
But not enough to get all puffed up about it.
All right. And Anthony, your hubbub.
All right. So my hubbub is about goatscaping, not to be confused with scapegoating. And this has to do with the Walsh administration in Boston. It's hired four goats from Plimpton Farm to eat invasive plants and poison ivy in a 2-acre area of Hyde Park. So this is innovative, natural, green way to clean up city property. I'm all for it. I like ghosts.
And makes for great photos.
Yeah.
I want to mention that yesterday, Boston was named a National Historic Site in Journalism. Now, we in the media industry will be quite interested in this, but I think even the general public will find this fascinating. Of the first seven newspapers in North America, five were published in Boston, including the first three. The Boston Post uncovered the Ponzi financial scheme. The original one, the Boston Gazette, coined the term gerrymandering. So a lot of great sort of media Boston newspaper history here. Boston, a National Historic Site in Journalism.
All right. John Carroll, Mass Communications Professor at Boston University. Thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor at the Boston Globe. Dante, thank you and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And listeners, stay with us. Lots more coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.